This is CBC News. Good morning, I'm Peter Armstrong. This is World Report. The federal government remains tight-lipped this morning about that series of attacks on its computer network. CBC News has learned at least three departments were targeted: the Department of Finance, the Treasury Board, and Defense Research and Development Canada. Ottawa maintains there is a strategy in place to deal with these kinds of security threats. The hack has been traced back to computers in China. But other than that, there are a lot of questions and not many answers about the breach, including whether Canadian businesses have also been targets. Our economics correspondent Mike Hornbrook has that story.
It's quite possible that there's a lot of hacking going on that we have not detected yet.
Charles Burton teaches Chinese politics at Brock University. He has written extensively on China's aggressive cyber spying program. No one knows what information the hackers were after, but Burton says when it comes to the Defense Research Agency, it's obvious.
Canada has access to secrets that are shared with other Western industrial countries such as the United States with regard to sophisticated weaponry, and the Chinese government would have strong interest in getting hold of technologies.
In the case of Treasury Board or the Finance Department, he says the hackers may have been looking for evidence of new international plans to pressure China to revalue its currency. Yet Burton says they're interested in a lot more than just defense and economic information.
Natural resources and the oil sector are very important to them, and so there have been allegations of Chinese sources also hacking into computers of companies involved in those particular areas as well.
Companies are reluctant to admit when they've been hacked. None of Canada's big banks will talk about it, not even the body that represents them, the Canadian Bankers Association.
Companies have an interest in not revealing when their computers have been hacked, because this impacts on the reputation of the company and the security of their data.
The Chinese are denying any responsibility for the attacks on the federal departments, but Burton maintains they have the most aggressive cyber spying program of any country in the world. Mike Hornbrook, CBC News, Toronto.
Meanwhile, the United States has failed to convince China to release an American geologist convicted of spying. A Beijing Superior Court is upholding an 8-year sentence against a man for selling a database about the location of Chinese oil wells. But the information, widely available in most countries, was only deemed to be a state secret after it was sold. CBC correspondent Anthony Germain has that story.
Disappointed, of course. We're all very, very disappointed.
John Huntsman, the United States ambassador to China, tells reporters the outcome was never really in doubt, but it's still difficult for 46-year-old Shui Feng, an oil geologist from Houston.
We ask the Chinese government to consider an immediate humanitarian release, thereby allowing him to get back to his family. He is a U.S. citizen, and we take this case very, very seriously.
And so does Beijing. The appeals court here upheld Xue's espionage conviction and an 8-year prison sentence. Xue was detained in November of 2007 while on a business trip, and he was charged for gathering information about the location of more than 30,000 oil wells that belonged to two powerful Chinese petroleum companies. In court, his lawyers argued the database Xue used was for sale on the internet and that the details about the oil wells were only deemed to be a state secret after his arrest. Today's ruling, in a court system that is not separate from political control, reaffirms the Chinese government's power to deem anything a state secret whenever it wants. Xue's case is one of many irritants currently plaguing Sino-American relations, and the case alarms the foreign business community here because it illustrates how what appears to be industrial research can retroactively be deemed espionage. Anthony Germain, CBC News, Beijing.
Tens of thousands of Egyptians are back in Cairo's Tahrir Square, celebrating the fall of Hosni Mubarak. The former president was ousted exactly 1 week ago. Despite the jubilant mood, some are anxious about what will happen next. Leading opposition figure Mohamed El-Baradei is among those wondering if the military will implement promised reforms.
We haven't seen any of the demands of the peaceful revolution that took place a couple of weeks ago with millions of people in the street being implemented. All what we see is terse military bulletins every few days saying this is what's going to happen. But what is the roadmap? What is, you know, how we are going through the transition, which is crucial to the future? Nobody knows.
A situation much like what we saw in Egypt is now developing in Bahrain, a showdown between a long-standing government and its people.
The death of the king.
Thousands turned out for the funerals of people killed yesterday in Bahrain's capital, Manama. A violent security crackdown on pro-democracy protests left at least four people dead. Tanks and heavily armed soldiers are now patrolling the city, and the military has banned all public gatherings. With more demonstrations planned, Western governments are urging Bahrain's security forces to use restraint. Up to 14 million Ugandans are headed to the polls today. Presidential elections there have been marred by controversy and threats of uprising. There's little doubt President Yoweri Museveni will win a fourth term after 25 years in office. But the opposition is calling the election a sham and threatening an Egyptian-style uprising. Carolyn Dunn has our story from East Africa.
This vote is widely expected to return President Yoweri Museveni back to power and extend his 25-year reign. Museveni is a former rebel leader who brought relative stability to Uganda after years of human rights abuses and state-sponsored killings in the 1970s and early 80s. But critics say this election is even more corrupt than usual. Museveni's popularity is waning, and the vote rigging and vote buying is expanding in response. The main opposition candidate, Kizza Besigye, predicts Ugandans will take to the streets in Egyptian-style protests if Museveni wins again.
Where the population is frustrated with the institutions of state, they take their power back to themselves.
But Museveni says that's unlikely. Nevertheless, he's placed police and the military on high alert and has warned that protesters will be dispersed. And the opposition leader will be arrested if his supporters try to take the election by force. Museveni enjoys the support of leaders across East Africa, including here in Kenya. To them, he's an ally who represents stability. But after 25 years in office, some fear Museveni's desire to cling to power could be the very thing that destabilizes Uganda. Carolyn Dunn, CBC News, Nairobi.
The federal government will spend millions of dollars to build support centers for returning soldiers and their families. CBC News has learned the money will be used to build five new centers, as well as improve existing ones. Ottawa is allocating $6.9 million for the project. Defense Minister Peter McKay will announce the details of the plan in about an hour. Well, some say it's the biggest secret in the car insurance industry. It's called diminished value, and it could be costing Canadian drivers millions of dollars every year. The CBC's Tom Harrington now on why insurance companies don't cover it and what might happen to change that.
Oh, yeah. The roar of more than 400 horsepower is music to the ears of Peter Phan. The Surrey, BC family man had his limited edition Dodge Charger rear-ended last year. His car is now worth $8,000 less than it was before the crash. The Insurance Corporation of BC won't cover that loss, so Phan is suing to get it back.
It's not about the money at this point. It's all about the principle now in the fight.
Unlike Peter Phan, most Canadians have no idea that when you decide to sell or trade in your car after an accident, it could end up costing you thousands. That loss is called diminished value. The theory is people will pay less than market price for a vehicle involved in an accident, even if properly repaired. Like these folks at a dealership in the Toronto area. As soon as they're told one of the two nearly identical SUVs they're looking at was in a crash, they say they'd only buy it at a much lower price.
Oh, I'll definitely want a huge discount on that.
I don't know, 25% maybe?
Off the price. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
What do you think, hun?
Oh my goodness. I would think like at least $5,000.
Despite those losses, Canadian insurance companies, both public and private, don't cover diminished value. We called the top five private insurers, and none would talk to us. So we asked Jim Bonnet, a longtime broker who surveyed the industry on the issue.
Basically, because it's very hard to quantify. You don't incur the diminished value until you sell the car.
Not so in the state of Georgia, where the law requires insurance companies to cover diminished value. Meantime, Peter Phan hopes his lawsuit will set a precedent that will make it the law in BC too, and maybe someday in every province. Tom Harrington, CBC News, Toronto.
Tune in to Tom's report tonight on Marketplace at 8 o'clock on CBC, or you can hear Tom on The Current this morning after the 8:30 news. That is the latest national and international news. For World Report, I'm Peter Armstrong.